This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, find out how a new type of solar panel could help farmers both generate electricity and still grow and harvest crops on the same piece of land. Now, Republicans in the U.S. House are hoping to use a debt ceiling increase to cut federal funding with a looming deadline that could threaten the global economy. Meanwhile, Democratic Representative Ilhan Omar was removed from the House Foreign Affairs Committee in a party-line vote, and Republican committees are kicking off a wave of investigations. We're rounding up some of the big stories in the Congress, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Debt ceiling. Do you want to see a negotiation of some sort? Do you want spending cuts as part of the debt ceiling increase, or should that be clean as the White House wants? Make those negotiations later. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Lisa Mascaro is an Associated Press Chief Congressional Correspondent. Lisa, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. How are you?
Pretty good. Well, let's start with this debt ceiling. First, give us a quick 101 reminder. What is this debt ceiling? Why would it need to be increased?
Yes, exactly. You know, this used to be a sort of routine vote in Congress, but over the past, decade or so, it has just become a very political, very treacherous sort of endeavor. What it is that Congress says how much the government can borrow each year to pay off the bills that it's already accrued, the money that's already been spent. We borrow a lot. Americans, as part of our government, we borrow a lot. We pay a lot of money every year to pay down our debt. And that amount, we're coming up against the limits of that. It's a sort of staggering number, $31 trillion, right? That's how much we are allowed to take out in indebtedness. But that needs to be lifted again, or the country won't be able to continue paying on the bills that it's already, that are already due. So this vote comes to Congress, and it used to be sort of routine, but now it's often been used, particularly by Republicans, as a leveraging tool to get some of the changes in federal spending that they prefer. We saw this about a decade ago when the Tea Party Republicans came to Congress, and they really pushed then President Obama into negotiations to try to form spending cuts, sort of dollar for dollar spending cuts, for every dollar more in debt, we'll have a dollar of cuts in federal funding. Those negotiations went on, and they made some progress. But ultimately, these are very difficult decisions. But here we are again. New Republican majority is very eager to confront Democrats and President Biden and try to initiate another round of negotiations to trim back federal spending before giving the vote to raise the debt ceiling.
Republican House Speaker Kevin McCarthy and President Biden met last Wednesday to talk about this debt ceiling thing. I want to give a listen to Speaker McCarthy after that meeting.
We both laid out some of our vision of where we'd want to get to. And I believe after laying both out, I can see where we can find common ground. There's nothing in there but me walking away that does not believe at the end of the day we can come to an agreement that makes America stronger, puts us on a path to balance, and exactly what the American people are asking us to do.
Now, these are two key figures here. We've got the Democratic-controlled Senate, Republican-controlled House, Democratic White House, and I think I've seen a Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell saying, yeah, this is between McCarthy, Speaker McCarthy, and President Biden, basically. Why are these two kind of the key players in negotiating this debt ceiling?
Yes, it's an absolutely interesting political dynamic. In the past, Leader McConnell over in the Senate has brokered deals with President Biden on these very same fiscal topics. This time, he's really stepping aside and letting the new Republican House Speaker, Kevin McCarthy, and the new House Republican majority take the lead. McConnell, he's a seasoned leader. He knows that these negotiations are difficult, and he's in the minority over in the Senate. So he really wants to see what the House Republicans can do, what they can get Biden to agree to, if anything, before he sort of sticks his own neck out, in his political fortunes and tries to cut a deal that, may or may not be accepted by anyone. So it's really up to right now that Republican Speaker McCarthy and President Joe Biden to see if they can find any common ground. This is the very, very beginning of negotiations. All of this doesn't really come to a head until summer, when the Treasury Department says, you know, that will be the inflection point. That will be the time when the government will really need to have that vote and ensure our creditors that we're good for our bills and we can continue paying our bills and that we won't have any default on our debt.
Talking to Lisa Mascaro, congressional correspondent for the Associated Press, looking at the big news in Congress this session, including the debt ceiling we're talking about now. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should Congress just straight up vote to boost the debt ceiling, or do you want to see negotiations to cut overall spending for the future before we agree to pay the bills of our past? What do you want to see Congress focusing on in terms of policy, investigations and oversight of the White House? You name it, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Lisa, some Democrats in Congress have been saying, well, McCarthy and the Republicans don't seem to have a plan, a starting point of negotiations. Do we have an indication from the Republican, the narrow Republican majority, of what kind of cuts they'd like to see in this process?
Right. This is where it gets difficult. You know, folks often say, yeah, let's make these cuts. We can find, you know, waste. We can find abuses in the system. We can find programs that, you know, people don't care about anymore. But when it really comes down to it, it's very difficult to find the cuts. And Speaker McCarthy knows, you know, he has a very slim majority in the House. So even getting all his Republicans in line, on board, on an overall plan will be a sort of Herculean effort. Now, he's going to try to do that. And there are a number of Republicans talking. There's, you know, many, Speaker McCarthy has said, look, the entitlement programs, especially for the older Americans, the Social Security and the Medicare programs, let's take those off the table. Okay, what about defense? Well, maybe there's some extra in defense that could be trimmed. Even those two starting points, not everyone's in agreement on that. Some people would like to see some trim backs in those entitlement programs. Some Republicans would like to preserve no cuts to defense. So we'll see what they can come up with. It's not impossible, but that will be sort of the task in the weeks ahead, to see what they can bring to Biden. And, you know, President Biden and the Democrats have sort of started this conversation saying, no, we don't really want to negotiate at all. But Biden has had this first meeting and they've agreed to have a second meeting. And so we'll see if they can start having that conversation.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Marty is with us in Palmyra. Marty, hi.
Thanks for taking my call. Hashtag hypocrisy. George Bush handed a $1 trillion deficit to President Obama at that time. Now Trump has handed a $1.3 or $4 trillion deficit to Biden. How did that occur? Now all of a sudden Republicans are worried about spending and spending cuts. Thank you.
Marty, thanks a lot for the call. I think whether you see one side or another to be the blame, it seems like if you're out of power, if you don't control the White House, your party is really interested in cutting the deficit. When you're in power, maybe not so much. Lisa, is that unfair of me to say?
Well, you know, I will say debt has risen steadily over the years. You know, it's been since the Clinton era that we last had a balanced budget in, I think, 2000. And, you know, deficits and debt has grown since then, first under then President George Bush, you know, with the wars overseas, then, of course, during the Obama era with the Great Recession and all the government spending. And so it has... It has steadily risen. And, you know, I will say Democrats tend to want to sort of increase, you know, the programs, and Republicans tend to want to cut them. So that seems to be where it falls on the party lines.
We're talking to Lisa Mascaro, Associated Press Chief Congressional Correspondent in Washington, D.C., about what's going on in Congress this session, including so far we've been talking about the debt ceiling coming up, some controversy over who gets to be on what committees. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see come out of Congress on the debt ceiling and when? Have you been paying attention to a story from our neighboring state? Representative Ilhan Omar removed from a foreign affairs committee in the House. Join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see Congress do this year? 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Lisa Mascaro, Associated Press Chief Congressional Correspondent, looking at the latest news in Congress, the big issues, debt ceiling, and more. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Lisa, before we go back to our callers, I mentioned just before the break there, Ilhan Omar, representative from Minnesota, removed from the House Foreign Affairs Committee, party line vote by the House as a whole. What led to that removal?
Right. You know, this is, again, an example of the way Congress has just escalated sort of the tensions and the differences. What happened with Representative Omar is a reflection of this growing sort of partisanship. You know, she came to Congress in the new class of 2019. She's a Somali immigrant, came to this country with her family as a young person, settled in Minnesota and got herself elected to Congress. When she arrived, she had made comments that were considered anti-Semitic. She had views about Israel that were very much concerning to her colleagues on both sides of the aisle. She has since apologized for those comments and said she's learning more and needs to be mindful. But it really stuck with Republicans that she should not be able to serve on the House Foreign Affairs Committee. And they voted to remove her. This, in many ways, was seen as an escalation, even perhaps a payback from what happened in the previous Congress when Democrats had the majority, and they made moves to oust the far-right Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia from her committees, and then later Congressman Paul Gosar of Arizona, the Republican who had both those Republicans had made incendiary comments, Marjorie Taylor Greene making hers before she was elected, and again, Congressman Gosar, after he was already elected, he had posted a video, a violent video, going after another, where he was seen basically killing another member of Congress, the outspoken liberal Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. The Democrats removed both of those Republicans for their committees, saying they were sort of extremist members and did not have a home in the House under Democratic rule. Well, Republicans took this action against Omar, but you know it's been a little trickier this time because Representative Omar has a lot of support now. She has apologized for her actions. She is, you know, a Black woman, an immigrant, a Muslim American. There are only two Muslim American women in Congress. And so it has taken on just a more tense tone here. So we'll see. This is likely to stand, this ouster. She's still able to serve on her other committees. But she, in a very emotional floor speech, very fiery floor speech, said, you know, she would not be silenced and that she would carry her message forward. You know, this all comes at a time of sort of increasingly sort of strained relations in the U.S. over some of the work in Israel that's happening among politics there. So I think it's just really something to watch to see how this continues to play out in the Congress. But I will say it's just been a very difficult chapter, it seems, for all involved, because it shows these just sort of escalating tensions across the aisle between Democrats and Republicans and how they are able to resolve, you know, their differences here, even on these kinds of matters, you know, among their own colleagues, among their own lawmakers.
We're looking at some of the big stories in Congress with Lisa Mascaro from the Associated Press. We have a couple more callers on debt ceiling related issues. Margie is with us in Milwaukee. Margie, hello.
Hi. I am totally against any kind of compromise on the debt ceiling. Those are debts that we've already incurred, and the banks would never let me go in and change my debt requirements. It's just something you can't do. And but if it goes forward and they want to reduce, decrease entitlements, they really should look first at the entitlements that we're still giving to the major oil companies and other corporations that don't deserve them. They've been carried along for a long, long time. And the Social Security and Medicare, we've paid into that through our whole working lives. That's something that was established for security of older age, and that's something that should stay.
Margie, thanks for the call. A couple things there, Lisa. First of all, Margie's last point, looking at Social Security and Medicaid. What's the latest on whether those would be part of debt ceiling negotiations, at least as far as what we're hearing from especially House Republican leadership?
Yes. House Speaker McCarthy has said more than a week ago now that both Medicare, the healthcare program for older Americans, and Social Security, which of course is the retirement income program, would be off the table, that those would not be subject to potential reductions during these negotiations. Now, I will just say, not all Republicans feel that way. So Speaker McCarthy is leading his party, saying that won't be on the table, but, you know, he does have to make sure he has everyone behind him. Medicaid, you know, which is the other health care program for those in need, often women, children, that's a different topic. Mm-hmm. It is an entitlement program, and one that Republicans have been eager to sort of trim back, or especially with the expansion of Medicaid and some of the states during the Obamacare expansions, the Affordable Care Act. That's something that might be in the sights. So that program, which is not for the older Americans, but for other Americans who are in need, many of them working Americans, that, could potentially be something that is subject to cuts. So I think the other thing just to remember is that, when you sort of take those automatic programs off the table, what's left is really a much smaller sort of menu of options to cut. It's either the defense or the non-defense accounts, and it does become just very difficult to find where they can cut. But we'll see. Maybe they'll be able to find some programs that all sides can kind of say, sure, we could trim this back a little or not let it grow as much in the future. There might be some areas that have been able to, they could sort of phase out, but those are going to be very difficult conversations to come.
And Lisa, just briefly, I want to get to one or two more issues. Republican committees in the House expected to do lots of oversight and investigations of various sorts related to the White House and I think COVID and more. What do you have your eye on for the sorts of things they'll be digging into?
Oh, my goodness. So many investigations. And we're really trying to get our heads around, which ones to watch, which ones are going to be the most important. Republicans, so far, their legislative agenda is not robust. They don't have a lot of bills for the floor. They're not rolling out a lot of legislative proposals. What they do seem to be focused on right now is this oversight arena, and that is across the board, everything from President Biden, his son Hunter Biden, his family, to, more specifically governmental operations. This week there will be hearings about the border, the southern border with Mexico, continued hearings about COVID and how the COVID dollars were spent during the crisis. And there's just a lot coming in this oversight and investigation arena. So we're going to be kind of trying to watch all of it and see what seems to be the most relevant, the most interesting, what they're going to really dig down on and what might be sort of, a couple hearings and then moving on. So it's a little bit hard to tell right now which of those will be, really the ones to watch.
Another story you reported on last month, it's still ongoing, this New York representative, George Santos, one is a Republican there. Long story short, it seems like everything he said about his life and resume was not true on the way in. What is going on with the latest on how he's being treated in the House, if he's on committees, if he's facing legal consequences?
Yeah, Mr. Santos was on the floor of the House this morning delivering a speech, just like any other member of the House. He doesn't seem to have a lot of allies and colleagues beside him in Congress, but he is marshaling on despite all of these questions swirling around him. He faces calls to resign from his home state Republicans. He's under an ethics investigation here in the House. He removed himself from his own committee assignments while all of this is playing out. So he is definitely a but not able to fully participate in all of the workings in the House because he's removed himself from these committees. And he faces, as you mentioned, a number of local and beyond investigations. So I'm not quite sure what will happen with him, but he's here. He's coming to the State of the Union tomorrow night when the president gives his speech. So for now, he remains a member of Congress.
And what is one big thing, Lisa, you're watching for in that State of the Union address?
Oh, goodness. That also is always one to watch. I mean, it'll be interesting to see if President Biden does roll out any new initiatives. You know, this split Congress with Republicans controlling the House and Democrats controlling the Senate, that can be a time of bipartisanship, you know, deal making. Yet, you know, it's also up to the president. So we'll see if he rolls out any initiatives that could be sort of something that both sides could embrace, or does he use his time to really showcase the differences of the parties? You know, the Democrats have really pointed a lot to the Republicans as extremists, and we'll see if he kind of goes down that road, or does he try to, you know, provide an open hand to any deal making with this Congress?
Lisa, thanks again for joining us.
You bet, Rob. Thanks for having me.
That's Lisa Mascaro, Associated Press Chief Congressional Correspondent. She joined us today to talk about what's going on in Congress, including the latest news about the debt ceiling. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, scientist Neil deGrasse Tyson joins the program. He's coming to Wisconsin for a look at science in the movies. You can get a preview. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. What is Wisconsin's number one college town? Well, it all depends on how you define it. According to one measure, the top college town in the state is Whitewater. This comes from the Washington Post Department of Data. They didn't define college towns by the size of the football stadium or the number of parties. They did a simple population comparison. How big is the local student body compared to the population of the city that they're in? So how big a share of the people you see are potentially college students? So you got UW-Madison, UW-Milwaukee, and Marquette. They're big schools, but they're in big cities. UW-Whitewater comes in at over a 50% student share of the local Whitewater population, making it number one in the state, 15th in the whole country. Rounding out the top four in Wisconsin with students as a share of local population, we have Platteville, Menominee, and River Falls, homes of UW-Platteville, UW-Stout, and UW-River Falls. Be true to your school. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, cartoonist Linda Berry is helping Wisconsin students get creative, and she'll share her insights into inspiration for all of us. Now there's that old saying, you can't have your cake and eat it too. You can't have two good things at once, I guess. Got it. So let's apply the saying to farmland, where the demands for surface area are getting more competitive between growing crops and generating electricity from solar panels. You can't do both at once, right? Well, our next guest says it is possible. Majdi Abunajim is an associate professor of soil biophysics at the University of California, Davis Department of Land, Air, and Water Resources. He's co-author of a study that appears in the American Geophysical Union publication, Earth's Future. Majdi, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, Rob, and thank you for having me.
Before we get into your development here, can you talk a little bit about what you see as this concern that there might not be enough land to go around if we want to grow crops and put solar power in rural areas?
Thank you. Well, I love your introduction. I think agrivoltaics is the closest to having your cake and eating it. It is probably the best available method that remove this tension between energy groups and food groups over competing over land. And it shows that this does not have to be a zero-sum game.
And you use that word agrivoltaic. What do we mean by that?
Agrivoltaic is a marriage between two words, agriculture and photovoltaics, which is the technology used in solar farms to produce electricity from solar radiation. So this is basically the idea behind agrivoltaics is simple. It is maximizing the land potential by simultaneously co-generating food and energy at the same land.
Now, here's where it's tricky. If I put up a solar panel, I would assume it's going to block all the sun. So if I try to plant plants in the shadow of that, I'm out of luck. And that's where you're doing something different. What is different about these solar panels you're working with?
Great question. So, yeah, it's all about harvesting solar light. And we want to maximize it, assuming that the solar radiation is the resource we're looking at and we want to make the best out of. What we discovered in our study and we showed through modeling and validations is that what plants want are basically photons. This is what they need for photosynthesis so that they can assimilate carbon and produce biomass. Photons are different depending on which light spectra they come from, and this is what causes the plants to feel thirsty or transpire. So if we use the low energy photons for plant production, that is the red band of the light spectrum, those are lower energy photons that will help photosynthesis without causing the plant to wanting to transpire more. And then on the other side, if we use the blue side of the solar spectrum for producing energy, those are the higher energy photons that will produce more kilowatt hours. So this is literally maximizing the potential out of every single photon on the light spectrum.
I want to make sure I have this right. I've got this solar panel. It's catching the blue end of the light spectrum and making energy out of that. But it's, I guess what, translucent? So the other part, the red stuff, is getting down to the plants that really want it?
Exactly. So this is the design that we're looking for. Those panels are still a concept. So we are working with different technology partners to see if we can do those. But we tested the concept with light filters, and we're actually getting great results.
Yeah, you tested those light filters. I think I read this right, with tomatoes.
We tested with tomatoes. Yes.
And what did you find? Were they hungry for more light, or did just the red light do it for them?
That's a great question. We are still in the phase of completing the data analysis, but we know that our yields were about 70% of what you would expect. But the good news is all the wastage we got this year, a lot of heat with temperatures reaching above 115 degrees Fahrenheit in California. And we got some bad tomatoes in the harvest. What we observed is that those filters help reduce those wastage by more than half.
You're hoping, so one side effect is it might cut wastage from heat. You're also thinking that a system, this agrivoltaic kind of system, could help with water use. What is your hope there?
Exactly. So it increases the water use efficiency because we're only providing enough light for what the plants need. All the extra light is actually harvested for energy. And this makes the less light get into the plant. So we're basically optimizing per crop and per location how much is needed. And then the idea is let's harvest the extra for energy production.
All right, Majdi, I know you got some farmers there in California. We've got some here in Wisconsin, too. If those farmers here are listening and saying, okay, this sounds pretty good, like how long would it be from where we are now to where an actual usable, practical pilot project might be available around the country?
We can start now. We don't have to start with those light splitting panels or agrivoltaic panels. Those might take a few years to be developed, but with shade. So when we start with the plant and the location, we know from plant physiology how much a crop needs. And then we know from the location how much light is there. And we can design the panel density over that land to be exactly how much we want to get rid of by producing electricity by that light.
And for these light separating panels now, where we could actually grow plants under our photocells, what's your next step in developing those?
I'm working currently with a few technology providers. We have a few designs that we want to test. I would say this is work in the making. Probably a year or two from today, we can produce and test those panels.
Majdi, thanks so much for sharing your research with us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Majdi Abunajim, Associate Professor of Soil Biophysics at the University of California, Davis. We talked to him about a recent study he co-wrote that found it's possible to generate solar power and grow crops on exactly the same plot of land. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the answer to a Wisconsin question about a county and its curious shape.
Joyce Salter Johnson has loved history her entire life. But as a descendant of people who were enslaved, her family history, like the history of many Black families across the country, was largely struck from the historical record. As WPR's Christine Hatfield tells us, Johnson had to take it upon herself to uncover her family's roots.
Who we are is determined by where we come from, our parents, where they come from, their parents, where their parents come from, and a chain of unbreakable links that could explain not only our genetic makeup, but also our personalities.
Joyce Salter Johnson's love of history started with a missing link in her family's history. She says her grandmother appeared to have no roots at all. She essentially lived alone in a nice house in the South that her grandfather sent money home to build while he worked on the Illinois Central Railroad. Johnson has always been a storyteller, and the holes in her family's history left room for her curiosity to thrive. When she reached adulthood, that curiosity transformed from fantasy into research. It took years to get answers to her family's story.
Before 1866, there was nothing written in any archive about slaves. Nothing. The information that you needed to find out about the enslaved person was in the archives or the databases or the journals of the people that held them enslaved.
Eventually, she traced the Salters back to 1792, when Hardy Salter was born to enslaved parents in Virginia. The journey of the Salters took them to Good Hope, Mississippi. That's where Joyce Salter Johnson grew up. Over the years, life led Johnson to Freeport, Illinois, and eventually Madison, where she's lived for more than 30 years. But it was Freeport's Historical Society that inspired Joyce's next historical endeavor.
So for years, we would always get these really nice publications about Freeport. And often it was a historic publication about Freeport. And there was never, ever one picture of any African American in those publications.
When she asked why, she was told there weren't records of African Americans living there, let alone pictures. So she began combing through the historical records herself, finding stories of centuries worth of Black settlers in the county.
In order for history to be accurate, it must present an inclusive record of all people. Unfortunately, in the past, a substantial portion of the history of the Negro in Stevenson County has been omitted. This omission has allowed generations of the county's residents, both Black and white, to grow up with a distorted view of Stevenson County and the roles African American have played in its development. And that's what I had to give to them, and they said, of course we'll publish your book. I place people of African descent in that time and place, in that space, where they should have been automatically put in that space.
Johnson says she's glad to see her books as more than just family history. She says they're textbooks people can learn from. As for herself, life has carried on through the years of research and hard work. She found her way into early childhood education and led Madison's Early Childhood Learning Center, taking in children who needed extra care. At 82, her work isn't done just yet. she still has another book to write and more history to share with the world.
Joyce Salter Johnson of Madison is the author of numerous historical books. WPR's Christine Hatfield brought us her story. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we search for the sources of inspiration and creativity with Wisconsin artist Linda Berry. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Now, where do you get your inspiration from? What does it take to get your creativity going? Our next guest has explored those questions in her own award-winning art and is helping students in Wisconsin find answers through their own work. Linda Berry is the creator of Ernie Pook's Comic, a comic strip that ran for 30 years. She's the author of the award-winning book Making Comics. In 2019, she received a MacArthur Foundation Fellowship, also known as a Genius Grant. She's the former Chazen Family Distinguished Chair in Art at UW-Madison, and Linda is the 2023 Mackey Chair in Creative Writing at Beloit College, where she's a professor of interdisciplinary creativity. Linda, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thank you very, very much. Actually, I'm professor of interdisciplinary creativity at the UW. That's what I teach at the UW. And then in Beloit College, I'm there as an artist in residence.
Gotcha. Well, you always have a lot of irons in the fire, Linda. I'm not too surprised about that. Now, one thing... I want to start with something that I learned from talking to you a long time ago. I think in our lives a lot, we outsource creativity to the professional creatives, the artists and musicians. You are really hoping that we reclaim some of our creativity. Can you give us some encouragement to do that?
Well, you know, right now, I think the thing I'm the most interested in is making drawings can be for people who gave up on drawing when they were little. Most people decide they can't draw at about, it's unfortunate, but it's at about 8 or 9 when they realize they can't draw a nose or hand. And then that's it. They just feel washed up. And for a lot of people, drawing just stops there. But one of the things I'm especially interested in is what happens if you bring drawing back in to the classroom in particular, if you bring it back in, but not with the aim of making a really good picture, but doing something like, for instance, bringing a classroom together. After, I think a lot of professors and teachers noticed that when the students came back after the pandemic break, people just had a hard time talking. They had a hard time getting together. They had a hard time just socializing in class. And I found out that if I asked them to close their eyes and draw a mermaid for 1 minute without opening their eyes, when they open their eyes, what they've drawn is so shocking and surprising and hilarious to them that the whole atmosphere of the room changes. So one of the things that people can do if they, you know, it sounds like it's not that big of a deal, but if you can close your eyes and draw something for 1 minute, you have to set a timer, you can't stop drawing. I always suggest that people start with a bacon and egg breakfast because everybody seems to be able to draw that with their eyes closed. And when they open their eyes, they go, hey, I got something going on. And then the mermaid's always hilarious. Statue of Liberty is really good to draw with your eyes closed. So it's all these things that you kind of think you don't know how to draw. When you close your eyes, for people who gave up drawing a long time ago, they can draw longer without stopping with their eyes closed than with their eyes open. Because with your eyes open, you start to argue, like, that doesn't look like the Statue of Liberty. With your eyes closed, you're feeling in the dark. And so that's something that I'm really interested in, how drawing can transform the mood of the room and also the person who's drawing. Like, that to me is amazing. All you do is close your eyes and wiggle your pen for a minute, and when you open your eyes, you feel you start. I had my students draw themselves as Batman today, just doing something that they do in the morning. You know, like Batman making toast or brushing their teeth with their eyes closed. And it was the same thing. It was like they all came in kind of tired. We drew ourselves as Batman with our eyes closed, and then the room was awake. So I find that amazing.
I think I see how that works, because you're talking to me. I gave up drawing. I'm terrible at drawing. But if if you said, Rob, draw something with your eyes open, I'd be like, I can't do it. If you told me, with your eyes closed, the pressure's off all of a sudden, right? Like, of course I can't draw something with my eyes closed. So, yeah, I'll give it a shot. Is that the kind of response you get from this?
Well, it's actually more, it's deeper than that, because you can't not, first of all, feel kind of crazy when you're drawing with your eyes closed. It's sort of like me telling you to go into a dark room and feel around until you find the figurine of the cat that's in there. So if we filmed you doing that, you'd look pretty crazy. Actually, part of the reason I have people draw with their eyes closed is I just love watching people draw with their eyes closed. The whole class looks like it's dreaming, you know. But then when you open your eyes, it's a kind of surprise that's really wild, because it's so different than what you thought you were drawing. And just that, to get a charge from drawing, and the drawing itself isn't that important. I mean, the drawing itself isn't, I mean, you might want to keep it, you might want to throw it away. You don't have to do anything with it. You can put it in recycling. But it's really, what I've started to find out is, it really is this powerful, powerful thing. And for teaching creative writing, which I also do, you can do a thing where I can read you a story, a short story, and then I'll have you close your eyes and draw a scene from it. And it doesn't seem like anybody could really do that, except for everyone.
Okay.
I've almost never met anyone who can't do that.
I just did the mermaid thing with my eyes closed while you were talking. I got the hair pretty close to the head, actually.
No, that's why it's funny. It's because your eyes are closed, and then you lift the pen, and it's like, where's the face supposed to go? And also, is she wearing like a shell bra? Like, what?
There's, I didn't
like
get that
all
detail.
These things.
Yeah.
You know? So, yeah, that's it in a nutshell. It's just a strange little thing, but it does surprise people. Today, the other thing I had them draw with their eyes closed, which everyone can do, is a castle. A castle for 1 minute, or a cat. There are all these things that we know the shapes of, and we kind of know the outlines of, but we don't necessarily know that we know that until we give it a try.
I want to before we run out of time, there's a line on your Tumblr blog that I really wanted to throw at you and have you expand on. You wrote on a piece of paper, drawing to have an experience rather than make a thing that is good or bad. And I don't know, that just really hit me as something really important. If we're not worried about, this is going to be a product that I'm going to like either be ashamed of or be proud to show people and do it for the experience. Can you talk about that for a couple minutes?
Sure. Like, say you go on a bike ride, right? And you go on this bike ride and you have a good bike ride and you come home and you feel like you had a really good bike ride. And then suddenly there's a knock on the door, and it's the guys who drive that Google car. Mm-hmm. And they say, did you just take a bike ride? And you go, yes. And they say, how was it? And you go, I thought it was fantastic. And they say, well, let's review the film. So, or let's judge this bike ride by the tracks that your bicycle made. So there are two different things. One is you're in it and you're having a full body experience that actually can change your mood, versus this piece of paper that tells you either did a great job of drawing that castle or you failed. And neither of those things give you much of an experience, except for an experience of never, ever wanting to do it again. You know, so there's just something to it. And at Beloit College, that's what I'm studying along with my students, because my students, for the most part, there are creative, or they're interested in creative writing. And so what I'm trying to show them is how drawing can help get you there. And also that there's something very similar about drawing and creative writing, in that they deal with images and they deal with your body. And they're very different than thinking, than trying to plan something out. It should feel a little bit like going on one of those funhouse rides at the carnival, or those horror rides. there should be a little bit of terror, but a good terror in it.
Linda, yeah. We'll leave it there. Thanks so much. Good to talk to you again.
It's so wonderful, and I want to just say hi to everybody out in their cars, driving home. I listen to this show all the time, and it's just, I'm thrilled to think that it's my little voice coming out of people's radios right now.
Well, it's good to hear you again, Linda. Thanks so much. That's Linda Berry, creativity expert, creator of the comic strip Ernie Pook's Comique, artist and teacher at UW-Madison and Beloit College. She joined us today to explore the energy of creativity. If you are the people out there in your car, don't try that eyes closed drawing trick just yet. I'm going to keep doing this. Do you get to see my mermaid? You do not. It's pretty good. Good shot. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we kick off a series of interviews with candidates in the election for Wisconsin's open state Supreme Court seat. And find out how Wisconsin's Focus on Energy program aims to help us conserve energy and get some ideas to help cut your winter heating bills. We'll talk about all that and more. It's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time on the Ideas Network. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then the new year has seen a lot of ups and downs in the electric vehicle market. The editor-in-chief of CarTalk.com joins us to explain the expansion of an electric vehicle tax credit and how that might set the stage for the rest of the year. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.